Being a Christian means being submerged in an endless sea of paradoxes. And it's frustrating, yes, because there's never really a clear answer as to what one must be doing on a day-to-day basis. But if we always consider God's intentions in terms of salvation, history, all that stuff, then it begins to make sense more and more. God is our Father, which means precisely that the method in which He is guiding us is Father-like, which means He takes personal care with each individual person, finds who they are, and then guides them into their full maturity and full development. And I learned this pretty quick when I noticed that my little sister received distinctively different treatment in our childhood than my brother and I did. This was not the injustice of my parents. This was basic common sense. She not only was 5 years younger than I am, because that relationship hasn't changed, she's still five years younger than I am, but then she has the difficulty of not only chronological separation from the brothers, but gender separation. So on so many levels, she was operating at a deficit. And so Mom and Dad had to do the necessary adjustments to kind of fit that through. And then, of course, if you were to just complain and say, well, it's not fair, I'm sorry to say that the well, it's not fair complaint is often used to justify a tyrant. A tyrant is always willing to find one small piece of justice, exaggerate it for their own purposes, and then say that they're fighting for righteousness. It is amazing how an entire civilization, blinded by their own feeling of ill deserts and ill treatment, can justifiably explain the mass extermination of a people in their own midst. One does not have to go too far in the 20th century to explain this. We go through this feeling of ill desert and victimhood. You know, they messed us up at Versailles, or the capitalists screwed us all up, or the communists screwed us all up. And then the result is this endless stream of moral justifications for moral evils, which is one of the reasons why being a Christian would never, ever allow us to have this kind of cold comfort to be able to say, I think I'm doing the right thing, therefore I am. One must always have before our minds this weird tension between, I know I seem to be going in the right path, but everything I'm doing could in fact be fruitless. Now, Solomon does screw up a great deal, but on this he's spot on. He builds the temple, something his father was not allowed to do. God forbade David from building the temple. He said, you're free to gather all the materials, do all the prep work and everything, but you have too much blood on your hands, you're not allowed. So David's like, okay, so it's my son that's going to do this whole thing. So he basically sets the entire stage for Solomon to build the temple. And a mystery that God gives to both father and son in their lifetimes is, I don't need your temple. You get this actually at the very beginning of the whole temple narrative in David's lifetime, where David says, I'm living in a palace and you're living in a tent. We heard this a few weeks ago. I'm going to build you a big house. And God says, no, you're not. Since when have I ever needed a house that you built? I made all this. Get over yourself. And then today, when we have Solomon saying to God, I have built you this temple, and so what? Really, in the end, what does it matter? And he knows, in the end, nothingness. That it's entirely the humility of God. It's an attribute we don't always think of God having, but I should never, ever tire of preaching of it. The humility of God that God says, I'm content to live wherever. That graciousness of the divine is precisely one of the things that also bugs us about him. He'll take us or leave us. He doesn't need anything we provide him. But he does want an open heart, which is why building a temple is still important. Unless we are willing to work for the faith that we have and actually have that work have real-world consequences, there's a good chance that all of our pious words in the end sound like womp, womp, womp. If we talk about how much we love people, but we are unwilling to go through the necessary changes in our heart to, in fact, love more, empty. If we claim to actually have this missionary impulse to bring the gospel to other people without being cruel and judgmental and et cetera, then there's a good chance that so many of our words are, in fact, womp, womp. To realize how important what we do actually is, and then to realize it is God who does the work in us. Now, if that is a paradox that will throw your mind for a tailspin, I can't imagine any paradox not throwing your mind for a tailspin. But the reason why Jesus warns us about today, in today's gospel, the hypocrisy of the Pharisees is something that can very easily settle in. When we know our gestures are meaningless and we hold on to them anyway. Washing of cups. Really? Now, of course, it's pretty important to have a certain level of cleanliness and then a certain amount of responsibility for how one does these things. You know, you probably wouldn't want to go to a house of a family who doesn't do the washing of the cups. There's a good chance if I was served food with dried spaghetti on the inside, I would be slightly I'd be displeased. But I would still have to be willing to eat whatever they put in front of me, as Jesus says. Therein lies the weird difficulty. When we know how difficult it is to have a real living contact with God, then we settle for these things. We settle for them. We presume that these human precepts are the thing itself, not that intimate communion of trust that God desires from us. He does not need our stuff. If he wants more money, he wants more offerings, fine, he'll just make them. It takes him everything to get your trust. And we Catholics are no better than the Pharisees in today's gospel. One of the classic signs of a person who's suffering from this particular type of hypocrisy is our tendency to always point the finger to other people's injustices. To always be able to say, it's their fault that the church is having struggles. It's their fault that my life is miserable. It's their fault, it's their fault, it's their fault, it's their fault. But in our church, have you ever noticed that we often use pointless categorizations to put ourselves into various little categories? Liberal, conservative, traditional, progressive. Paul has another comment about this. I follow Cephas. I follow Apollos. I follow Paul. Some would say I even follow Jesus. These really just don't matter. And too often they put Christians in categories of human traditions that are only 100 years old. Christians have been around for 2,000. One can be totally a Christian and not even know what being a liberal or a conservative means. So herein lies our great problem. It's not so much first that we start social projects and then be converted. We first know Jesus Christ, and then he introduces us to other people. He deepens not only our contact with him, he deepens our contact with each other. He puts us to work in visible human projects for the good of everybody, for the common good. Maybe it's building a temple. Maybe it's working at your local soup kitchen. Maybe it's volunteering. And yes, we do need good people for politics. But those things must never define you. Because only God knows your real name. Only God knows the purpose for which he made you. Politics might just be a temporary sojourn for your great part and your great vocation. Whatever your job might be right now may only be a temporary thing along the way. Actually, most of you know this far better than I do. I'm much younger than a lot of you. We grow in this faith by knowing that when everything in this world has passed away, there will only be that brief encounter, that eternal encounter between you and God. And he will ask, have you followed me?